Bonjour.
Hello.
I'm Jonathan Green, and you're listening to Lost and Found. Today, a journey of the mind to Montreal. But to be honest, this time round, I'm more keen on going on a journey of the stomach, because I'm hungry. Lenore Newman is the author of Speaking in Cod Tongues, A Canadian Culinary Journey. Lenore, take us to Montreal.
Let us imagine it is winter, because somehow it is always winter in Quebec, at least in the popular imagination. And to the point, their unofficial anthem is a song that goes, Mon pays, ce n'est pas pays, c'est l'hiver, which means my country is not a country, it is winter. And Quebec's cuisine reflects that cold, wintry country. And one of the best examples is maple syrup, because maple syrup requires cold weather to create the flow of the sap in the trees that then leads to all of the good things that flow from that. So as the trees begin to wake up, they have warm days and very cold nights, and that stimulates the sap flow that then is captured, boiled down in the most wonderful Canadian food tradition, which is the Cabana Sucre, or Sugar Shack, where you go from the city out to the maple forests, and they feed you a ginormous meal that is perfect for a cold, snowy day.
How do we tap that sap?
Well, it's a very old technology that has some modern twists now. So in pre-colonial times, Indigenous people would slash the trees, gather the sap, and boil it with hot stones until it became powdered sugar, because it was easier to carry. Then when settlers began doing it, we drove what's called a spile into mature trees, and it's like a little tap. It's literally like you put a little tap in the tree, and the sap runs out, and you carry it in buckets down to a sugar shack, or Cabana Sucre, where it is boiled and boiled and boiled until you have a syrup, which they then traded. Today, we take a few shortcuts, which instead of carrying it in buckets, we use plastic tubing. So you go into the forest and it's like a maze of plastic tubes full of syrup that take it to the sugar shack. And the other thing we do is we use reverse osmosis filters to pull some of the water out. But that last stage is still boiled over a fire, just like it used to be several hundred years ago.
In that sugar shack. I take it, though, that changes in climate might be quite critical to the performance of that tree.
Yes, and climate change threatens this tradition in a couple of ways. And that's a real problem for us because, number one, if it's too warm, the sap doesn't flow in the same manner, that up and down with the cold and the warm. And so you get less sap production. And we've seen that in the United States, where sap production is falling, and that's moving north into Quebec. And the other thing that happens, we start to get wild weather swings, including ice storms. And ice storms are the great curse of maple forests, because the trees in the winter are quite brittle. And if ice builds up on them, they get broken. And we had a very major ice storm, about 20 years ago now, that was epic. And it dropped sap production 15 to 20%. And so that's a big problem for us. It's a problem for the farmers, because Quebec's farm has a landscape of small farms that do very high quality production. Maple is the first thing they do in the season. That money is then used to buy seeds to move forward. So that early maple with the tourists coming out, making wonderful Canadian dishes, and there's a lot of maple dishes, which I can, go on about at length if needed, but we're worried we're losing that culture and production will fall. And for Canadians, this is a very big cultural item.
That sap in its raw state, as it's tapped from the tree, what does that taste like?
It's a bit like sweet water. And so in we have to concentrate it by about a factor of 50 to get maple syrup. But even the water itself coming out of the trees, it's kind of like a sweet water. Sometimes it's sold in bottles as kind of a new age kind of power drink. But to me, it just tastes like kind of sweet water.
Favorite maple dish?
Oh, so many. I love maple. A good maple syrup, especially later in the season, it begins to pull the minerals from the soil. It gets a little darker, has a bit more of an earthy taste. There are several classic dishes. Now, the one that is quintessentially Canadian is Terre Diable, which is you pour the syrup over snow to create taffy. And so cooking with snow, how Canadian is that? But my favorite is a dish called pudding chaumaire, which means poor man's pudding. And it's definitely not a poor man's dish anymore, but in the tradition, it was sort of cake and maple syrup and cream mixed together, which is delightful. And now you can get a very upscale version in Montreal and Quebec City that really uses a good heavy cream and good quality cake and syrup, and it's just delightful. And then, of course, if you want to go back to basics, pancakes and maple syrup are classic. And at the end of the day, if you haven't had enough, a good maple whiskey can be a pretty nice thing.
A maple whiskey?
Oh, yes, makes a lovely cocktail.
Lenore Newman.
Ah, well, with a bit of a fire in the belly from my maple whiskey, I hit the pavement and walk through the city streets. There are road signs, shop signs, advertising in both French and English. I've heard conversations, exclamations, in my case, yes, directions. They are being given in varying languages. So, how should I respond? Monica Heller is a Canadian linguistic anthropologist, a professor at the University of Toronto. Monica, bonjour.
Bonjour, hello.
Well, this is the issue. Is everyone in Montreal bilingual?
No, not everyone, but increasing numbers of people since, say, the 1970s or 1980s. There's probably more bilinguals in Montreal than other parts of Canada, except for maybe Ottawa. And also, Montreal has the highest rate of trilingualism in the country.
Oh, and the third wheel is?
Well, it's a language of immigration. It can also be Indigenous languages that are have increased in their use, Mohawk in particular, Iroquois language. But unlike other parts of Canada, where immigrants tend to shift over, at least to some extent, to the dominant language, usually it's English outside of Quebec, in Montreal, people keep the language they came with and add English and French onto that.
The Anglophone-Francophone divide, historically, what happened there?
Well, colonialism, in a word, double colonialism, actually. So initially, this was Iroquois territory, Mohawk territory. And then the first European incursions, we were the French, claimed, so the island of Montreal, actually, was the place where Jacques Cartier landed in 1534 and claimed the territory for the King of France. And then went away, came back a couple of times, got stuck in the ice. It was a bit problematic. No settlers until the early 1600s. And England and France and other imperial powers were busy fighting wars all over the place. As a result of one of those wars, New France was ceded to England in 1763, traded in part for Martinique. In fact, Voltaire famously said that Martinique vaut bien quelques arpents de neige. It's, you know, Canada, just a bunch of snow. Who needs it? Give it to them. Montreal was actually mainly, was in terms of population, mainly English up until about the end of the 1800s.
So as we travel around modern Montreal, are those boundaries intact? Do we move from linguistic pool to pool?
Well, partly. So it's certainly intact in the popular imaginary. Hmm. So Montreal's an island, right, in the St. Lawrence River. And in the middle of it, there's an extinct volcano, which we call a mountain, even though it's like a hill. So the Anglos kind of live up that hill on the western side and then off to the west in the direction of Ontario. And the Francophones live on the eastern side in the direction that the river flows in to the Atlantic, okay? Then kind of in the middle, on the eastern flank of this mountain, there's a north-south street that kind of cuts the island in half. It's called the Boulevard Saint-Laurent. And so this is kind of imagined as the dividing line. As immigrants come in, they tend to start settlement at the foot of Saint-Laurent, more or less, a little bit up from that, and kind of move up Saint-Laurent as generations gain access to social mobility. And then when they kind of get to the top, they kind of fan out along the northern part. So immigrant neighborhoods are sort of the buffer zone in some sense.
Let's get to cases here. If I'm arriving in Montreal and hopping into a taxi, how do I give my instructions? In which language?
Well, you're the client, so you can do whatever you want.
What would be polite?
Would be to do it in both. One trick is to listen to what radio station the driver is listening to. Although what will happen is that as the driver will be sizing you up as much as you are sizing the driver up.
Of course.
You know, let's say you don't sound convincingly French, then they'll just, you know, kindly change the station for you. To make you comfortable. These kinds of negotiations can go on endlessly. You know, most people enjoy it. Some people find it frustrating, but mainly it's fun.
Monica Heller. Bonjour, à conducteur. Amenez-moi Marlène de car je voudrais manger plusieurs bagels.
Hello, driver. Could you please take me to Mile End? I would like to eat several bagels.
Leslie Chesterman is a Montreal restaurant critic and food writer. Leslie, what is the difference between a Montreal bagel and a New York bagel?
Well, of course, the Montreal bagel is a million times better, and I will tell you why. I'm in my early 50s, and I've heard about this whole scandal all my life. And the funny thing is that I actually like both, but they're, you know, it's like apples and oranges. The New York bagel is like kind of a big bun with a hole in the middle. I mean, I'm sure it has its charms for certain reasons, but the Montreal bagel is quite a dense little, I don't even want to say pastry, because when we think of pastry, we think of butter and flakiness. It's a kind of a bread. But first of all, it is boiled in this water that has honey in it. And then the Montreal bagel is roasted in these wood-burning ovens. You know, it's a lot sexier. It's not just kind of a roll with a hole in the middle. We have like a whole other process. But what's really nice about a Montreal bagel, it's also covered in sesame seeds. I'm sure like nowadays they cover bagels with everything. Mm. But the Montreal bagel, I mean, this wonderful synergy between the sweetness of the honey water, the density, there's a chewiness to this bagel. We'd like to think that there's this wonderful wood-fired flavor, which is not true at all, because actually they've made it in regular ovens and nobody can tell the difference. But it's kind of a tighter crumb, as we say in the industry. And, you know, it's just more interesting.
This antipathy between Montreal and New York on the subject of bagels is entirely mutual. The New York Times food critic Mimi Sheraton said of Montreal bagels, and Leslie, I quote, they are too thin, sweet, not salty, so many seeds atop, it's like chewing broken glass.
Oh, I remember when she said that, and I had it out with her on social media, and she's completely wrong. And as much respect as I have for Mimi Sheraton, who's one of the great restaurant critics of all time, she's got this one wrong. And broken glass is very dodgy to say that. I'm very upset. You brought it all back. I forgot about it. And you brought it back that she said that. But we took that. We didn't take that very well. Obviously extremely jealous.
I'm sorry to be so triggering. The origin story of the Montreal bagel, how did this separate? Where did the honey come in? Where did the wood-fired oven emerge?
You know, there was, so there are two big places to get bagels in Montreal. There's Saint-Viateur Bagel and there's Fairmont Bagel. And what's, you know, I find what's actually more interesting than the Montreal and New York bagel fiasco or debate is really the local Montreal one, which is some people will only go to Fairmont and one, some people will only go to Saint-Viateur. So Saint-Viateur say they started the bagel and Fairmont, you know, they're saying they're older. So the real rivalry is not international, it's municipal, it's local here. And they're really fanatics about which they want. I mean, years ago, I interviewed Nigella Lawson, and at the last minute, I got this very cryptic request to bring her 24 Fairmont bagels. And I thought to myself, wait a minute, how does, she didn't just say 24 bagels. She she was very distinct about which one she wanted. And they're two blocks away from each other. And I mean, really, you have to be very picky. For me, it's wherever I can park. But there are lineups for both of these bagel shops, and people are very specific here, you know, at each other's necks about which bagels are better.
This must divide even families.
It does. And it just shows that in the winter, we have nothing to do here but fight. And of course, don't even get me started on smoked meat and pastrami, because that is a very ugly situation as well.
Could I get you started on smoked meat and pastrami?
Well, okay. So the big thing in New York is they have pastrami, and here we have smoked meat, and the big rivalry is which is better. And actually, one of the most interesting things is that a smoked meat sandwich in Montreal will cost you less than half of what a pastrami sandwich will. You know, if you go to Katz's Deli or something, you're paying a fortune for a sandwich that here is very inexpensive. And a very interesting thing happened here is, like, the mecca for smoked meat is a place called Schwartz's, and years ago it was actually bought by Celine Dion.
Wow.
I heard a silence there because everybody's a little shocked when you hear that. But Celine Dion and her late husband purchased the Schwartz's restaurant and the whole smoked meat mecca that comes with it. And it was quite interesting because it's kind of very Anglo-Jewish Montreal specialty. And it was bought, like, from the international French-Canadian queen songstress. And yeah, I mean, the thing is, I mean, they're both excellent. We get so caught up in the food world about which is better, you know, what's better. But, you know, we kind of have to accept things for being good, you know, as long as it's not awful.
They can be equal but different.
Yeah, they're different, but they're very different, and I think they're both good. And that's kind of the line I'm giving all the time. Although smoked meat is hard to beat. I mean, really, gun to my head, I'd go for the smoked meat before the pastrami.
Well, I am trying to dislodge in my mind the association now between Celine Dion and smoked meat, but I will attempt to do this with this question. As to when does the typical Montrealer consume a bagel? What's the normal pattern of consumption?
You know, I always said that you're not a Montrealer unless you have sesame seeds on the carpet of your car. And so, like, the big thing is that the bagel shops don't close. They're open 24/7. And so usually if you go clubbing or something, when I was younger in the 80s, when people used to go clubbing in the city, now everybody sits around, I don't know, with coffee or I don't know what, natural wines. But back then we'd all go clubbing. And on the way home, we'd either go and eat French fries with mayonnaise, which was very cutting edge back then, or we'd go and pick up a dozen bagels and eat like seven of them on the way home when they were warm. And then the next day it kind of would like cure the hangover, because all those hot bagels would produce this huge ball of dough in your stomach and absorb all the alcohol. So that was the big thing, is you'd get them at night, you know, before. And now it's just, I really think that, I mean, you can get all these bagels in our local supermarkets. And my sister lives in Paris. When I go to Paris, I bring her 24 bagels. And, you know, it's kind of a thing about being a Montrealer. We kind of take it for granted, to be honest.
On the Anglophone, Francophone divide, where do we find the bagel?
That is a great question, because the thing is that I find as an Anglophone Montrealer, because of course the majority here is Francophone, and that we had years, we came very close to separating. We have a political party that wants to separate, although right now they're not doing too well. But there are a few things that bring Montrealers together. One, smoked meat, two, bagels, and I think three, like this, a great sense of humor. And the Quebecois people are extremely, you know, funny and gregarious and fun-loving. And the Anglophones are here too. I mean, there are a lot of things that divide us over language and politics and religion, but the bagel is really something that brings us together. Everybody here really loves Montreal bagels, and we're proud of them because, you know, they don't have bagels in Toronto. They have pea meal bacon, which is not very interesting.
I'm sorry, they have what?
Something called pea meal bacon, which is back bacon, which is kind of a lean bacon that they roll in pea meal. I still haven't quite figured out what that is, but it's not very interesting. So, you know, Toronto economically is a force, but Montreal wins on the food front.
Well, let's speak about that broader food front in Montreal, because that language and heritage division in the city must throw up some interesting things in terms of dining and cuisine.
Well, yeah, of course, this week it's extremely weird, right? Because everybody is kind of canceling their restaurant reservations because of coronavirus. So suddenly it's, because that's a big thing to do in Montreal, is to go out. And, you know, our restaurants are fantastic and not too expensive compared to a place like, you know, London, where it's extremely expensive. Mm. And the food here is fantastic. And we have a real dining out culture. And people are quite sophisticated. For instance, you know, if you have a restaurant here that serves offal, you know, kidneys or liver, people just jump right in. Whereas if you're kind of in English Canada, they kind of, shrink back in fear and drink beer. But here we're very, you know, we'd like to think that we're more sophisticated.
Leslie, it has been an honor. Thank you so much.
Well, you have to come to Montreal now, and I'll take you to all these great places and we'll have fun.
Leslie Chesterman. And then it's time to go. The poet and musician Leonard Cohen, a famous Montrealer himself, once said, "Some say that no one ever leaves Montreal, for that city, like Canada itself, is designed to preserve the past, a past that happened somewhere else." It seems nearly every culture has a stake in adding to Montreal's history. Speaking of, I know someone else who has a big stake in the Montreal food scene. Restaurateur Lenny Leiter.
Well, interesting story. My father immigrated from Romania. He came on his own when he was 13, settled into this area, which is known as the Main in Montreal. It's the area where immigrants did, and to a certain degree still, arrive and start their new lives in Canada, in Montreal. My dad was working in this area, and he ended up working in a restaurant. The restaurant's name was Safrine's. My dad, besides working here as a server and busser, was also a gambler. And Safrine, the proprietor, was a gambler. And one night in 1938, they got involved in a poker game, and Safrine lost the restaurant to my father. And my father, at that point, became the owner of the restaurant, which was called Safrine's. He changed the name to the Romanian Paradise in 1938. The war broke out shortly thereafter, and because Romania was on the wrong side, he decided to change the name once again to Moishe's. And it's been Moishe's for 82 years.
This is a tremendous story of restaurant survival. That is a remarkable span. When did you first meet Leonard Cohen?
Ooh, we're going back probably, I would say, mid-70s. In those days, and up until he passed away, owned a home, and when he was in Montreal, and he was always in Montreal in the early years, and later years, he spent most of his time in California, but he owned a house just on the street next to ours, and so he was always close by and often in the restaurant.
Was he a creature of habit? Did he have a regular order?
For the most part, he loved lamb chops and Bordeaux wine. He would have other things and try other things, but, you know, that basically was his mainstay.
Was he a good tipper?
I don't know. I wasn't on the receiving end. I never asked. But, you know, he's a generous soul and a generous spirit. So I would have to assume the answer is yes.
Lenny, thank you so very much.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Lenny Leiter speaking to us there from the backstage area of Moishe's Steakhouse. You've been listening to Lost and Found. This week, from Montreal, Canada. Vous avez écouté Lost and Found, cette semaine, Montreal.
You heard from Lenore Newman, author of Speaking in Cod Tongues, A Canadian Culinary Journey, Monica Heller, Canadian linguistic anthropologist and professor at the University of Toronto, Leslie Chesterman, Montreal restaurant critic and food writer, and Lenny Leiter, owner of Moishe's Steakhouse. Producers are Mira Adler-Gillies and Lisa DeVissi. Technical production by Matthew Crawford. Je m'appelle Jonathan Green.